Hi, my name is Mira Patasin. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today has had an awesome career. He has worked on games such as Mirror's Edge Catalyst, A Way Out, and It Takes Two. He is the co-founder of Keepsake Games, and his studio has just recently released their game Jump Space into early access. I'd like to welcome Philip Koulianos. How you doing?
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you for being here.
This beautiful morning. I don't know what time it is where you're at, but...
Well, it's evening here, but it's morning there, so
Are we perfectly offset 12 hours?
But it's not too late, so it's fine.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Just as an icebreaker, I'm going to ask you the most important question you'll ever get asked, okay? Why is Half-Life 2 the Citizen Kane of video games? Because you believe that it is.
Oh, wow, yeah, definitely. So I think... It has many layers to the answer. Has many layers, I would say. But I think for me, Half-Life 1 was this sort of perfect blend between an action game that also told stories. Like there were, you know, Deus Ex and all these games that were really deep into storytelling and sort of good atmosphere. But I think they were too slow. And I back in the day when I started playing these games, 98, I didn't do English very well, so it had to be short and sweet whatever the characters were saying, right? And I think Half-Life just sparked the imagination of you know, this sort of very rich world, and I think Half-Life 2 became even bigger because back then I was really into the modding scene, and I became into making computer games thanks to Half-Life and Half-Life 2. So not only did the game itself kind of, I mean, obviously it was like a huge success, and it had a fantastic story and a fantastic world combined with amazing, you know, the physics and sort of puzzling and action and all these things kind of blended together extremely well. But it was also personally for me a very transformative period in my life where I went from, you know, this is what I'm going to do the rest of my life. You know, I want to make games like this. And I was a big part of the Swedish community for level designers. Usually we were all teenagers at the time, you know, but different parts of Sweden. And, you know, sharing documentation. Because back then, you know, we didn't have YouTube. You can just fire up a YouTube video on how to make a level. You know, it was all... So we would do a lot of translation, going like, okay, how do you set the thing up to even open the level you built? How do you build a level without, you know, having everything breaking down? Because it was a lot of rules. It was very technical. And then we would meet a couple of times every year, have a big LAN party with people all over the country, you know, sitting, creating things. And I think that really set off sort of my journey into becoming a professional game developer. So for me, it's kind of like, it's not, well, it's a lot about the game itself, but it has so much more to it because it brought me together with a lot of people who've been close with ever since. And then, of course, it helped me start the career that I'm on. So yeah, it's I'm forever thankful, I would say.
Good answer. Was there anything from Half-Life 2 that you took into Jump Space?
Yeah, I would say, so the thing is, a lot of things initially, I would say like all the movement was very much like Half-Life 2, but over time we've sped up the character. And I think to be fair, I actually think the movement in Jump Space is better, but I think it's because the world
well,
has moved on.
Well, of course you have
on.
To say that.
But I think the world has moved on a little bit. Like Half-Life yes. today feels a little bit slow. And I used to have a wrench in the game. We're going to bring that back. So we're going to have a few items that are kind of placed in homage to the Half-Life series. But I think in general, it's more like, it's very strange to say, but it's like, I would say Quake and Half-Life has, because they kind of share a little bit of the same DNA technology-wise, like the way you collide with the world and the way the code kind of propels the character through the world is sort of has a feeling that is still today like top-notch, and not a lot of games do that well. Like when you walk into a wall, you stop. It might sound weird, but you know, you have a lot of games that do a lot of head bobbing and a lot of weird things where it doesn't feel like you're being blocked by the wall. You're kind of almost like this, kind of like closer to the wall. Like it's a lot of subtleties there that I think we kind of nailed. We're not there yet, but it's still, so it's very subtle. And I think also you have the characters in the hangar. You kind of like very simple interaction. You walk up and you press and they talk and they say like a sentence. I mean, a lot of other games do that, but yeah, there is a bits and pieces around that I think I usually say like, oh yeah, well, do you want this feature? Okay, is it in Half-Life 2? Yes. Okay, then it's a good idea. Let's put it in. That's usually my gauge. They even have this joke at the office that's, you know, like time until Philip mentions Half-Life, you know, is usually about 3 hours. So like before lunchtime, I would like, oh yeah, but that's like Half-Life. Okay, that's good.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So it's become a meme almost.
Yeah. But you do make a very valid point about how much the first person shooter genre has evolved over time. So stuff mm-hmm. that was probably amazing when Half-Life 2 came out obviously might feel a little bit, I suppose, dated. And you've worked on Battlefield mm-hmm. and Mirror's Edge, so does that give you more of a glimpse into like how these subtleties and nuances work in first person?
Yeah, I would say so. I never worked on Battlefield actually. I only worked on Mirror's Edge, but I think what we have sort of where we have involved in the sort of the first person kind of movement and all these things and interactions and how we kind of improved on a Half-Life is actually mostly, I would say, in animation. Like we started animating the character, the head. So like when you're doing a reload, for example, or when you're doing an interact, it's not only the arms doing things, it's actually the camera is also moving to kind of accentuate like the movement of the hands. Half-Life does not do that. And I think that's and with a talented animator that like that makes all the difference in the world. I remember when we did not have an animator for quite some time at Keepsake Games. So we were like trying to get around having very advanced animations, but then we managed to hire a fantastically talented guy. And he started doing all these subtleties. And I said, the first thing I said when he came to the office, like, okay, so let's make sure that you can animate the first person camera as well when you're doing all the cool movements of the hands and everything. And he's like, okay, no problem. We got that in. And suddenly, you know, the game's level of polish went from here to here. It was like a huge difference. So I would say like, that's the biggest change. When it comes to like the character sort of moving through the world and colliding with things, I don't think anything has changed at all. I think there's like probably less optimized code now than it was then. It works exactly the same. So I think it's all about like how you move the camera and have that kind of emphasize the movements that the character is doing. Whether you're landing, like you jump from a big ledge and you fall down on the floor, in Half-Life, the camera would just go like completely flat. Whereas today you would add a little bit of a bounce. So it's like, woof, you have that sort of, as you were in reality, you would land jumping from 1 meter down. You naturally, your head would kind of bob a little bit because your body is sort of absorbing the impact. So a lot of these subtleties are there today that weren't there back then. But I would say that's the main difference. So like I usually moan about how little has changed. Like, come on, man. Like, can't still be that great. Like, what have we been doing for 20 years, you know? But yeah, there are improvements, but I would say it's mostly in the animation of the camera. So it's all quite nitty-gritty and nerdy, but yeah.
But has there been any, I suppose, massive steps to mitigate potential motion sickness? Because I think that's a problem that still affects some people with first-person games. And was that something you were aware of when you were making Jump Space as well?
So I think with regards to motion sickness, I think it's a myth that game devs care about that stuff, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. I have never met anybody who were like, oh yeah, we did some science and we realized this works better. I don't think that's the case.
I mean, like, more as in if you have people on your dev team that might be susceptible to motion sickness. So, for example, I remember speaking to the lead project designer of Portal 2, and they experimented with walking on walls, and a few of the devs got motion sickness as soon as they tried to do that.
So I think that's the level of science that happens. You know, if someone in the team gets sick, then you're like, oh shit, yeah, okay, this person can't work on this level, so we have to do something. You're like, no, we didn't have that. We kind of knew that, okay, you know what, this game, if you're standing on the outside of a ship and it's sort of spiraling around, the whole world was going to spin. That's automatic puke. But what are we going to do about it? Like, this, yeah, the world will spin, you know? So we did not actually sort of, yeah, we appreciate that this is a thing, but we couldn't really, almost made an active decision not to try to chase that down, because it's like, it's just going to take so much time. We just hope that, you know, once we set the game in closed beta, that we wouldn't get too many people saying, I can't play, and we were lucky there. So.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing any complaints about motion sickness or anything with the early access of this game.
Yeah, so. No, which is strange. I would expect that to be quite bad, actually. But yeah, it's just... Because I haven't really found any real kind of science papers or anything that sort of, or general advice in the industry. Okay, you know, if you make a game that moves a lot, it has to be 60 FPS or 120 FPS. That makes it better. Like, stuff like that, right? Yeah, we would assume, but I haven't really seen anything like that. So what we do is basically allow the player to kind of turn off the animating the camera and sort of camera shakes. So, like, that helps some people, but it's very different. Like, my wife, for example, she's extremely sensitive. You could have a first-person camera, and then I would just rotate it 90 degrees to the left, just move it slowly, and she'd be like, no, I can't watch this. This is too much. Just having a camera looking to the left, not even moving the character or anything, she can't. So there's, like, it's so different. I think it's very different depending on the individual as well. It's a tricky one.
Because I feel when I was younger, I'd be able to play pretty much any FPS. But as I've gotten older, I don't know if my eyes have become more sensitive or something, but, like, I find if I play a first-person shooter that has too much motion blur or too much shaky cam, I'm just like, oh, you know. But then there's some games I can play that are fine. Like, I can play Doom, no problem. But I find that with films as well. Like, if I'm watching a film and there's too much shaky cam, that starts to mess with me. So,
yeah. And my wife says, like, oh, whatever the camera guy is doing here is like, no. And I'm like, I don't know. What's okay? So, yeah, I can see that. But yeah, I think like I mentioned, now that you mentioned it, like, allowing the players to tune down those sort of micro movements of the camera to some people is sort of the one thing that seems to be standard nowadays. But in terms of, like, do you play as much games as you used to?
Probably not, because I don't have as much time. So
yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yeah, so that probably has something to do with it as well. Yeah,
because, like, at least from my personal experience, you know, playing around with VR back when that was cool, I decided, like, you know what? I'm going to do, you know, all the things that would cause me to puke until I stop puking. And then just get used to it.
Good to know.
So that I think exposing yourself, like for example, sitting on the tram or the train can also be for some people difficult. But if you do that every day, you will get better at sort of. So I think it has a little bit to do with your exposure to whatever's causing it.
I'll have to test your theory, and I'll play more first person shooters, and then I'll come back to you. Yeah.
But can you sort of with a VR kit like move your character with a WASD without getting sick?
No, VR is like that's pretty horrible for me. Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't play a lot of VR games, so
no.
That does tie into what you're saying. So there's probably an element of truth to that. Yeah. For sure. So I wanted to ask about the third person, because obviously you basically have first person, then you go into third person with like the jetpack, and then it goes back into first person. Was that always the intent?
It was, I think we're going to do a lot more of that, actually.
Hi, my name is Mira Patasan. I'm an author and I'm an activist, and GoFundMe is my go-to platform for fundraising. The first GoFundMe I did was to raise money for a chapbook or a collection of poetry and essays and short stories. So we started a GoFundMe and our goal was $7,000. What I've learned that is so special about GoFundMe is that it's a whole collection of people offering anything from like $4 to $400. And each time you get a ping that someone donated, even if it is just $4, it's so exciting. So if you have a goal and you get there, you can keep making it bigger and bigger and bigger. We did go past our goal. It was amazing.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
That's
pretty sick.
Yeah, and I think it sort of has a really nice effect. And I think it also gives us a chance for you to look at your own character from sort of a third person perspective. Like, you know, you can customize your character, you can you will be able to unlock cool suits, cool helmets, stuff like that. And I think it's sort of important that you get the chance to see all that stuff. So that was not the main reason why we did the jetpack. I think the jetpack was just like the visual effect, and the feel of speed would sort of be emphasized much more when you see the character from third person, so you see like what's going on. And I think, like, for example, emotes today, when you're dancing or waving, you don't see much in first person, but like going out with the camera to third person, you know, seeing what your character is doing is sort of really helpful. So I think the rule we've been having up until this point is like, either, you know, when we have the chance, go to third person, and if your character is in a state that is not sort of normal character movement, let's say you're being tased, you're downed, you're lying on the floor, to kind of tell the player what's going on, because your movement is not what it used to be. Going out with a camera, showing a character lying on the floor or jetpacking is a way to communicate without having to sort of show an icon or say something. You see and you understand immediately, okay, I'm locked down now because a taser drone is sort of tasing me. I can't move. So it's a tool for communication as well as it is sort of, you know, sometimes emphasizing a certain emotion, like speed, for example, which is very difficult in space. Like, everything is so far and so distant, and like you don't have much to work with compared to driving a car. You know, all the things are flying by. But in space, you're like, yep, that asteroid is moving very slowly, it seems. And the only thing we can do is throw some gravel at the camera, right? Like some small rocks. But it helps if you're flying, you see your character in Superman mode, kind of, and the camera chasing that character kind of emphasizes the sense of speed. And we can play with FOV and stuff like that to make it feel like you're moving faster.
Did that take long to implement? To do all that camera work? No.
No. No. No.
Good,
like,
programmers.
Yeah, I think we've sort of like, so me and actually the programmer who's doing the character movement, we both worked on Haze Light and It Takes Two, where we do so many crazy things with the camera all the time.
Oh, yeah.
So for us, it came kind of natural to be like, okay, of course we need, it's called a spring arm, where you sort of have the camera sort of attached to the player's hips, for example, but you can still rotate it around the camera looking from third person. So technically that's called a spring arm camera. And sort of that's been that area and field of science has been explored for quite a while. So like this, most coders who've been working with a player character kind of knows how to do a good spring arm camera. So you're like, okay, we need a spring arm. It needs to collide with the world, you know, and sort of behave in certain ways. Okay, let's do that. And like I said, in It Takes Two, there was so much of that going on that, you know, we didn't even think twice about it. Like, we came from that environment. Because like in It Takes Two, you know, there's so many mechanics going on. It feels like you did 30 games in one, basically. So you had to work very fast. You know, you're like, okay, from concept, like an idea to a finished sort of 10, 15, 30 minute level would usually be like 3 or 4 weeks, and you had nothing when you started, and you're like, okay, but I'm going to be a toad, and then I'm going to ride this thing, and I'm going to, you know, and like you had to work in a, you had to work in a, with a certain mentality and a certain mindset to be able to be that productive. And I think that carried over a little bit to Jump Space as well. So yeah, for us, it was not really a big deal to put that in and sort of make it happen. Maybe it took a week, and then I was like, yeah.
I mean, you do mention It Takes Two, and that's just like, it just feels like endless and endless amount of mechanics, and the level design is just amazing. It does remind me a little bit of Nintendo games. Like a lot of devs that I speak to, when they refer to Nintendo, they use the analogy of an onion, right? So they peel back a layer, and then there's another layer and another layer. And I kind of feel like It Takes Two is a lot like that. So were you guys referencing like Mario games and stuff when you were making that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, like we had a bunch of guys in the design team who were, you know, very into Nintendo games, very into Super Mario and stuff. I was like, dude, this is not Half-Life. What is this? So I had to do a lot of, I mean, yeah, sure. I played Super Mario 64, which I think is still absolutely amazing. And I think like the movement is still today incredible. The camera, however, not so good. But like that was like the first game that I ever had it, so like, yeah, it's fine. So we did a lot of studies, you know, how does the camera work in, you know, the spring arm camera, the third person camera, work in sort of the latest and greatest Mario. And I would sit together with a programmer going like, you know, looking at it, sort of like, okay, what do they do when it collides with things? So you like really broke it apart.
So like frame by frame, you were looking at this stuff?
Not frame by frame, but like almost, you know, you would really like, okay, I'm curious in this edge case, what would the camera do if I squeeze it up against the wall, like walking into a corner and like the camera doesn't really have any space to move? Like, how do they solve that? So just like, usually you would ask yourself, have they come up with something brilliant, or are they just doing what everybody else is doing? And then you kind of see, usually it sounds like we're sitting there in a test lab or anything, but like you just play the game for half an hour when you have a question, and then that's that. But so we looked a lot at Nintendo, and I think, but I also, like I said, like some of the guys, especially in the movement of the characters in It Takes Two, we had like a group of 3 or 4 designers who were really into platforming games, and they kind of had a collective vision of what they wanted. So it was more about them just doing their thing, because like they were just miles ahead of everybody else. Okay, you know what is good and what is bad. Let's just let you guys do whatever you want to do. So there was a group there, and then they had like one programmer who was like implementing the sort of technical aspects, and then one designer who was very technical, who could do a lot of the code as well. So they would like sit together and actually implement the movement, and then you had the little cabal of designers around there kind of giving opinions. And then of course Joseph Farris, the game director, would of course be in the loop, but he also let them do their thing, because you could tell like, okay, these guys are just really into this stuff, so we know it's going to be great. But yeah, we looked at a lot of Mario, and I remember, because like we had so many mechanics, and then I don't remember which Mario game it is, but you have like hats. So like the Mario can put on a hat, Odyssey, and it turns into something. Yep. Yeah. And we're like, shit, why did they come up with that? We wish we could come up with something like that. That's brilliant. Like you have a mechanic where you interact with something and you turn into something. That would be amazing for something like It Takes Two. I mean, we worked around it in a way, you know, like the characters become different things depending on the story and the chapters, right? But we also thought like it would be you know, the one step more elegant if it was hats or something you put on your character. So like you start a new chapter, you are this. So yeah, that was a comment that we just made, like, ah, this is so brilliant and more elegant than what we thought we did in It Takes Two. But at the same time, I'm not sure the players would see it that way. They would just play and have a good time. They wouldn't really like, okay, not really ask any questions because the environment is so hilarious and crazy anyway. So
yeah, it does feel like with that game that you just, every single idea that you thought of, you're just like, oh, we'll implement that and we'll implement this and implement that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was like that. The first, I would say, 6 months, like, because we were moving to, you know, blah, 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 technology. They had to set up the whole project and the coders had, you know, we had done it a way out. We were done with that game. It was hugely successful. So we knew, like, okay, you know, the case like it's going to be around for a while because it was really like make it or break it. I was ready to just take my stuff and leave. Not because I wanted to, but because like we put everything on the line. And if the game didn't sell well, it would be game over, right? Luckily, it did really well. So then we were like, okay, It Takes Two. If you look at it from a technical perspective, it's actually very similar to A Way Out. It's like both are split screen, both are multiplayer. You know, we're gonna sort of seamlessly transition between cutscenes and gameplay. The difference would be like, okay, there's a lot more going on and more sort of power to the player and more mechanics, of course. But if you take a step back from that and just look at what needs to be presented on the screen from an engine perspective, it's very similar. So the coders had a very good vision of how they wanted to make that work a lot better than in A Way Out. And they needed time to do all that stuff. So during that time, we were just like, what are we going to do? Okay, crazy stuff. So we would just sit in design team every week, come up with a new mechanic, a new interesting way to have two characters sort of interact with each other, where they kind of needed each other. And then we would sort of, some of those ideas stuck and some didn't. So that was like the very, very first, was just very kind of anything goes, which was very stressful for me because, like I said, it wasn't Half-Life. And
well, it sounds like you're also learning this stuff on the fly, right?
Yeah, you have to. But like, it's because for me, the thought that I had in my head was like, okay, if we're making a game that is so fantastic and anything goes, any mechanic, any idea you have, we can make. If the game is not going to be fun, it's on me. It's on us. Because like in A Way Out, for example, like it was not so much about the game being, you know, it was just a story about two characters and sort of you couldn't make the characters fly. You couldn't do anything exceptional. So a lot of the cool kind of gameplay ideas like wouldn't make sense because like that's not what a character does. So you could always like, oh yeah, well, it's not the most sort of engaging game in terms of gameplay mechanics, but that's not what it's supposed to be. Ah, okay, whatever. But this time it was the other opposite. Like, okay, if the game is not fun, it's really on me to sort of take that responsibility. So that was really concerning until you kind of got into that mindset of, I think it really helped to kind of make new mechanics every 2 weeks or something and just have this eternal kind of land party. It almost feels like, you know, where you just threw stuff at the wall. You became very good at coming up with ideas that you could implement quickly and sort of try out. Because that was also a very big thing that I don't think most studios do, is that the designers or whoever had the idea of a mechanic would also be the one implementing it, at least the first draft. Like some mechanics were, of course, a bit too complicated to do alone. But if you're responsible for your own ideas, you also quickly learn to filter away the ideas that are very time-consuming or you would only kind of put your time into something you would believe in yourself, right? Because if you kind of worked on something for 2 weeks and then you had nothing to show for it because it didn't work out, you would look like the idiot in the weekly meeting. So there was some pressure there every week. I remember, like, because you were presenting to everybody, like, okay, this is what I've been doing. And then, you know, the studio director, Joseph, would sit there and be like, okay, that's cool. And then if you had nothing, he'd be like, why? what happened? For a full week and nothing? Nothing? So that was actually a big driver. I mean, very stressful to some people, right? But also, I think it helped. You sort of getting out of your shell and sort of put everything aside and just sort of make things at a huge pace. I think it helped for sure. So it was a great motivator, even though it was stressful.
So what's it like working with Joseph? Because he seems like the type of guy to me that would make sure that your energy is always high. He seems like a very energetic guy, which I would think would ripple into the rest of the team.
Oh, yeah. We worked together actually since, I think it was like 2010. So I worked with him for almost 10 years. I remember the first day I met him because he had an idea to make Brothers of Tale 2 Sons. I worked at Starbreeze at the time, and that it's not the Starbreeze we know of today with Payday and all that stuff. Back then, it was a completely different team who made, you know, Chronicles of Riddick, Escape from Dark Athena. It did The Darkness. It was like hardcore, first person, kind of dark, violent shooter games. And then we were at the end of production of Syndicate. Things weren't looking bright. It was really hard to find a new project. And then Joseph showed up and he's like, hey, I want to make this game about two brothers. It was very different from anything that Starbreeze had been doing, but they just needed something. And he was probably a person who could sort of throw in some money and sort of at least occupy a bunch of the guys at the studio. So he showed up and I was assigned to the team. And I remember him showing up and he would be completely crazy. Like, he could not sit down for 5 minutes. He'd be running around. And I remember, like, I'm sitting there like, what's going on with this dude? Like, he's exactly like, you know, he's not pretending when he's on stage. Like, he is like that. And when he was younger, he was much more crazy. So I remember, like, okay, let's go for lunch. When he would, you know, had his presentation, we'd go for lunch. And he'd be like, hey, look what I can do. And I turn around and he's like climbing up the wall of a facade halfway to second floor. And I'm like, we're going for lunch, dude. But what are you doing? And he's like, yeah, but this is super cool. Like, he would just be. So that's the one thing I remember. He's like, he would be running around like almost like a, not clown, it's not fair to say. Like, he was really funny and he would do funny things. And whatever came into mind, he would do. The other side, which I think is really interesting from a game developer perspective, is that he came from the movie business. Right. And when people are on set, the clock is ticking. Money is flowing down the drain. If someone is not doing what they're supposed to do on stage or on set, sorry, you know, that could delay the whole production a full day. And that would mean $10 million down the drain. So, like, he had that mindset when you were sitting and working at the studio, meaning I remember this very clearly. Like, we would sit sort of in a row where, like, back to back. So, you know, one person could, like, look down the aisle and see everybody back to back what they were doing. Because we had that lined up and he would sit at one end. So he would see everybody's screen at any given point of time. And I would stand up because I needed to go to the toilet. And he's like, Philip, what are you doing? Oh, yeah, I'm just going to the toilet. He's like, ah, yeah, okay, that's fine. Yeah, go. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but there was that sort of sense of, like, when you're at work, you're working. Okay.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there could be breaks where we would have fun, but you would, like, we're not fucking around. Like, money's on the line. We got to make this happen. And sort of he brought that sort of mentality. But I think it works on sets to be that into it, because on a set, like, you don't work like that for years and years. You do it for 3 months and then you're back to your normal life. But in a game dev studio, of course, you know, doing that and have that intensity years and years is a bit too much. So I remember, like, after Brothers, the studio, basically the office closed down and Joseph went on other things and we kind of separated as a group. I went to Stockholm, worked at DICE, like I mentioned before. And I remember, like, still having that in my back of my head. So the first day, you know, I was setting up my computer and I needed a gamepad to kind of, for my desk. It wasn't there, so I need to go to IT. So I stand up, go to IT, and on the way in the corridor, I meet my lead. And I'm like, shit. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm just getting my gamepad. And he's looking at me like, what? You don't have to explain it. What are you talking about? Like, yeah, of course. And I'm like, oh, Jesus, I've been brainwashed by Joseph. So, but yeah, with time, I think sort of that sort of intensity kind of has watered, like now it's very different, I think. But it was quite intense. He would sort of demand, like not demand, but like if something wasn't going well, he would be like, yeah, but like, why haven't you done anything? Like, why did this fail? And he would look at you like, explain to me why it's been a full week and you have nothing to show for it. He wouldn't say it like that, of course. But you would like, oh, you know, he has that aura. You really want to perform. But it's also really funny. Like, it's really fun to be around him. And like I said, you know, him climbing up facades, maybe he doesn't do that nowadays, but it's still, you know, he would show around in the office and sort of goof around and do crazy things. So I think the Joseph that you see on stage receiving prizes is very much how he is. But there is this other, okay, the third side is also quite interesting. Business. He is super good at business and deals. And he makes people very uncomfortable because he's kind of a bit unpredictable. So like, he would show up in a meeting and he would be like, hey, look how many push-ups I can do. And he starts doing push-ups and everybody's like, but what's going on? and he would be like, oh, no, this deal is not good. You know, like, then we stop production and then everybody goes home. He's like, what do you mean? No, like, yeah, but I want this deal to be my way. Otherwise, we're all going home. And he would kind of, if he feels like he has to, he will go quite far to kind of make a certain deal happen or sort of, and people kind of go into negotiations knowing that he is like that. With that said, he's not, like, he always used to say that, you know, you can, business and sort of creative has to meet halfway. Like, he's very business oriented in the sense that, you know, you have to make money as well. He's not just like, you know, all hunky dory is flushing down tons of money in the toilet. He's quite the opposite, actually. He would be like, no, stop working on this. This is good enough. He can say that. This is good enough. Stop working on this. You know, this is only 5 minutes of the game. Yeah, it's not the best. Whatever. Let's focus on the big sort of highlights of the game instead. Like, so he's very good at sort of finding that thing. But yeah, he also has that sort of, like, when he needs to, he can be extremely good sort of in negotiations and business as well. I've never met anybody who can sort of control the room in a way. And sort of all these suits would be like, shit, okay, what's going to happen? If we don't give him what he wants, like, what's going to happen?
Well, he's probably self-aware of that too. But you can just tell, like, he's a unique individual.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you can just tell. I mean, when I've seen him at the Game Awards and stuff, I'm like, this is not someone you can control at all.
He can't control himself, to be honest. Like,
it's like the guy has permanently had like 10 cups of coffee or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He has a lot of energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now that's the calm version. Like, he doesn't climb the facades anymore.
interesting. But yeah, cat.
No, I love working with him. It was great. Like, that was actually me quitting, resigning from Haze Light to start Keeps the Games. Was the toughest day of my life.
What was the main reason you left? Was it just because you wanted to explore things on your own and do your own thing?
Pretty much. Yeah. Jump Space. I was about to say Jump Ship.
Well, you changed names three times, didn't you?
Indeed. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, I've been working on Jump Space for since 2012, I think, just as a hobby project. Because, like, I mean, I've been professionally level designer, so building levels my whole life. And then I thought, you know, making games was so fun. And then working at a studio, I would be, you know, meeting all the programmers and all the artists and sort of being super inspired and kind of go like, okay, but I want to give all these different things a go. So the idea came from just me seeing a game called Artemis Bridge Space Simulator or something like that, which is like, you know, a multiplayer game where you play the bridge of sort of a Star Trek ship. So like, you have one person who is in helms and he would just have a screen with all the dials for the helms. And then you had one pilot who would just fly and sort of very locked into your roles. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what it takes to make a multiplayer game. Like, 'cause I couldn't code that. I didn't know how to do that. And then I would be like, okay, let's try it out. and sort of I would do all the research necessary and kind of like put together a prototype and sort of exploring game development and all the different aspects of that that was not specifically level design, but like code and art and all these things. And I would do that for like up until 2019. So it has a long story. So I put up a video where, you know, showing the game in 2019 that kind of got a lot of traction. A lot of people thought, wow, this is really cool. Even though it was just like, it looked like a finished game because I had put a lot of effort into the art and all that stuff. But people, but I knew it was just a demo, technical kind of demo. So, but people didn't know that. So they would be flushing into the Discord channel. I would have thousands of people and I would be, you know, it was Sunday evening and I'm sitting there by myself in underwear. Like, I don't even know how to ban someone. Like what is happening? So I had to like, okay, you know, who like just in the audience of all these thousands of people, like I need someone from the US who is willing to be a moderator now. And I'd be like, yeah, I can do it. Okay, good. You're now a moderator. Make sure nobody spams. I need to go to bed. Bye. And then my phone would be plinging all the way the day after, like as I was at work, you know, people trying to talk to me, thinking I was a company, right? They thought it was a group or a company doing this game. And so that sparked the idea that, okay, you know, maybe this is not what they're looking for because it's just me goofing around for a bunch of years, not really caring about sort of the commercial aspect of what I was doing. It was just me exploring game mechanics and technology. But the vision, the fantasy of sort of what Jump Space became was certainly something that was very attractive to a lot of people, because otherwise it would not be in the Discord channel. So that's how the seed was planted, that like maybe there is something commercial here. And that's what led me to eventually resigning then as we were wrapping up It Takes Two to kind of explore, because like I could not, working with that game for so long and then not at least trying to make it a commercial project at some point in my career, I knew I would regret for the rest of my life. Even if I loved Hazelight, I still hang out with all those people all the time. You know, I would never forgive myself for not trying, you know? And then the way the industry works is, you know, people know, but they don't realize like every project is 3 years, 3-4 years. So if you say, this is my honor system is like, if I commit to a project, I will finish it, right? So I'm like, okay, if I stay, I'm going to work on something for 3-4 more years. Maybe that's too late then. Like, because like we were also at a point, like me and a very close group of friends who founded Keepsake Games, we were all magically in a position where like we were all ready to move on to something, or could if we decided to go. So there was like, we felt as a group like maybe this is the moment to kind of start something. If we're going to start something, it's now, because we don't know where we're going to be in 3-4 years. Maybe someone has moved abroad or whatever, you know, like kids, family, I don't know. So we decided to give it a go, and that was the moment. And yeah, it's, so that was the reason, really. It's not because I didn't want, I would love to stay at Hazelight, to be honest. Like, it's a fantastic workplace, and I grew so much, and I learned so much from everybody there. But I just felt like I had to do this thing, or else I would regret it. Yeah.
What a cool story,
man. Even if it would turn out it sucked, I would still have had to do it, you know.
Well, the amount of people that are interested in the game, I think one of the hardest problems for indie games is just getting eyes on it, right? Like marketing. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And just having people interested in it. And obviously there's a lot of people that have taken to this game. I mean, mm-hmm. how many people were signed up to the wish list?
Over 1.1 million. Yeah.
I mean, that's a crazy amount, right? So
it's awesome. So this is, yeah, it's incredible. And this is where I'm so thankful. Like, I'm not the CEO. So our CEO is a friend of mine who's been very much in sort of the business side of game development for a long time. And like, we didn't know shit. I didn't know shit. I didn't even know what a wish list was. And I'm like, the way I thought marketing was working was like, okay, you just make good game, put on YouTube. That's it. And I think that would be my marketing plan. Having it not been for him. And he kept talking about, like, he worked at, it's Daniel, who worked at...
Daniel Kaplan.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, so because he worked at Mojang, didn't he? On
exactly.
Minecraft.
Exactly. Yeah. He worked on Minecraft, but I think most notably, it doesn't roll off my tongue. So there are studios down in Skövde. They do not the Factorio game, but like the other one. There is like a very nice commercial version of Factorio that is like first person. What is the studio called? I can't believe it. Okay, Goat Simulator.
Oh, yes, yes. I was going to look it up.
The studio called?
Goat Simulator. Hold on.
Developer, yeah.
Yeah, I got to look into it now.
Coffee Stain Publishing. Sorry, Coffee Stain.
Yes, there we go.
So that is like an amazing, like in Sweden, like amazing publisher company who started because they did, you know, a few game devs did really well and they started a publishing part. And he was part of that. So he had been publishing a lot of really successful games, including, the names today.
It's all right, man. It's early in the morning. It's fine.
Yeah. So, oh, God.
We can just say that he knows his shit. There we go.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah. He knows his shit. He's been around for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, he's been around. So he's like, wishlist. I'm like, what is that? And he's like, yeah, we got to have a mailing list. I'm like, mail? People deal with that shit? Like, what? But it turns out, like, he really opened our eyes or my eyes to how it all works, because it's actually kind of a little bit of a science how you know you reel people in, you grab people's interest, and once you're interested you want them to kind of call to action, like, okay, you like what you're seeing, click here, you like what you're seeing, sign up for this email list, and we have hundreds of thousands of people sign up to this email list, and I'm like, I didn't believe that was possible, but it was very simple. You just have a web page, if you like what you see, sign up here. And people do it. So another thing that I didn't realize how important it is like we work with sort of a small agency, like who kind of hook us up with a magazine. So they are sort of our contact surface with sort of the all the magazines and all the YouTubers and all that stuff. So they kind of hook you up with all the sort of people around there, and I just thought, like, in my world that did not exist. I didn't know that there are people who professionally do this as a living, you know, like who are very good at sort of, oh yeah, you need to talk to IGN, okay, no problem, we'll fix that, or oh yeah, GameSpot, or okay, so you're gonna do a marketing push in February, okay, we'll line up, you know, 20 interviews or whatever. I had no, like, I thought that's what, you know, maybe EA would do that or Ubisoft or something, but I didn't know that it actually trickles down to much smaller studios as well. And sort of he was, you know, directing all of these things. And I was just sitting there like, holy shit. Okay. There is a science to all this stuff.
He probably has a lot of context as well, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Because he's
been in the industry for so long.
Yeah, of course. He would be like, yeah, you know, I would do all this stuff myself, but, you know, I'm a bit rusty, so we have to have an agency doing it. You know, and I'm like, yeah, so what? Yeah, it's fine, you know. but yeah, so there is a lot of math going into, you know, you have this many wish lists, how many percent of them convert to sales and blah, 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 blah. It's like a lot of math and a lot of graphs. And I had no clue it works like this. And also, like, when you have your launch, you know, how many sales you make the first couple of days is sort of derived from the wish lists, and then sort of the fall off, like, sales going down is almost like radiation, you know, like Half-Life, ha ha ha. So it's like, it's almost like that kind of curve where it goes sort of down and then it sort of flattens out and sort of, okay, but if you do marketing pushes or updates, you can sort of make bumps into that flattened curve. And I'm like, what? Oh, Jesus. And it kind of dawns on me how, you know, when you're working with a lot of like masses of people, hundreds of thousands of people, like it all becomes math, it becomes particles, it becomes percentages and sort of plots on a curve, basically. But at the same time, for each individual who is enjoying the game, you know, that is a very personal experience to them, right? So that's just the business side of it all. That sort of evolved into something that, like, is quite calculated, I would say.
How do you pivot though? Like, because if I recall correctly, because you guys released this in September, right?
Yeah.
But like, say Team Cherry, they announced Silk Song and gave it a short release window, which is obviously like the GTA of indie games, right? It was, mm-hmm. It was such a massive thing. So were you guys looking at that and being like, do we move the date? Do we keep it as it is? Like,
oh yeah.
How do we respond to this? Because it was they did a trailer and it was like 2 weeks, I think, after they dropped the trailer that the release date was happening. And I know some indie devs were like, oh, hell with this. And then they moved the date. So were you guys having discussions about this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You do all the, like, I mean, I'm trying to stay away because I'm like, I'm pretending to be this creative who only cares about the game. But so I'm like, Daniel, I trust you. Clearly, you've been doing amazing work so far. Like, keep doing that amazing work. If you have a question or like you're 50-50 on something, maybe I'll pitch in. But like, but yeah, there was definitely discussions about that. GTA, we didn't know it was going to be delayed. And we knew like even the biggest AAAs would also be like holding their breath. You know, are we going to release in September? Like, what if GTA does it? Like, nobody admits it. But we used to joke in the
everybody
studio
does.
Internally.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just joke internally that like they are obligated to the rest of the industry to let us know 6 months ahead, because everyone has to talk about this game. Meaning, if you are launching within those 2, 3, 4 weeks, you're screwed. Doesn't matter if you're Battlefield, doesn't matter if you're Assassin's Creed or whatever. It's like, you're screwed. So yeah, those discussions are up all the time. And we were lucky because we had nailed our date before Silk Song, and the guys were like, I mean, I didn't see it myself. I was in at Gamescom at the time, but they were like seeing the black screen, and then the September started fading in. They're like, oh shit. Then it said 4. It was like, okay, we dodged a bullet there. But yeah, Daniel has pushed releases of games because things like this before. So he's that's a real thing.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's so important, right? The first impression is the most important, and like that release date really does matter.
It does.
That's why I was curious. I was like, oh, did you consider this? And then obviously there is the GTA effect, but that would have been the same for everybody.
Absolutely. Right? But I used it as an example because it's like, it was, yeah. But I mean, I hope that once we reach sort of 1.0, that we would be the ones setting the date, and then everybody else would be like, oh shit, you know, JavaScript is coming out. We have to.
Well, you said that your aim is to create the best space adventure game of all time. That's the aim, right?
Yeah, that's definitely the aim, yeah.
Yep.
I think we can do it.
Yeah.
Here is the thing.
I love it.
Here is the thing. So, like, I'm not ready to sort of share any numbers, but like, we've been doing, like, I think we said 150,000 sales or something, or 200,000. I don't know what number we said, but like, we're doing really well financially, so we can keep going. Like, people don't know this. We even had IGN kind of question, like, oh yeah, it looks promising, but you know, there's still a lot of work to do. How long are they going to make this game? And I'm like, oh yeah, it's not obvious for people that we're planning to do this for at least 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So, and now we're sort of financially guaranteed that's going to happen. So I can say that with confidence, and I can also say with confidence that we're not going to release until we kind of are confident about the game. It's not been, I think, you know, people are used to seeing millions and millions of copies the first week, because that's all you see in the media. But for a team of 16 to sell what we're doing is more than enough. And we're super happy about that. So I can say that with confidence. We are going to aim to make the best basic adventure game.
And I don't think that tells the whole story with like AAA games. They have to do millions the first week because of the insane budgets they have, right? When you're a smaller team. Yeah.
That's the scary realization, is that like, now that I've seen a little bit, like, okay, this many wish lists, okay, that converted to this many sales, and we have been extremely fortunate and sort of had a huge sort of focus on our game compared to all the most other games. We were like top 15 on Steam when we launched. You know, that's like one of the top 1.1% of all the Steam games or whatever when it comes to like exposure and stuff like that. And you know, we're selling this money, like, we're not in the millions, right? Yet. But then
like
you're
that
thinking,
you said yet.
Yeah. It's a yet. It's a mathematical certainty.
Hey, I love happen.
It. That's the interesting part about when you're working with this many people. Like you can know almost like, okay, it's going to happen at the latest this date. It's just math. Anyway, what the scary realization is, even if we had that exposure we've had, it was not a guarantee that we would pull in enough money to keep running. Because even 16, which sounds like a low number, you know, there is a certain cost every month, right? And for us, it's fine. But I'm thinking of, you know, most people say like, oh yeah, 90% of all businesses fail, you know, within the first, you know, first game or whatever. Yep. I would now, knowing a little bit more, looking at the numbers, I would say 99.999% fail. I think most big games probably fail as well, even if they sell millions. Because like, there's no way, like, because we are, I would say like 50 times our size studio, like 500 people. How many, like 1 million or 4 million in the first week is not going to be enough to feed. And then you have this all 100 people for 4 years or whatever. Like, I think there is a good reason why there are so many studios going bankrupt right now. And it's because of this. Like, big studios tend to kind of, it seems like for a while, it seems like every new game or every new big title every year was like 100 more people has been working on this. Like, oh, we have 200 people. Next year it was 300 people and it was 400 people on this studio. And they kind of reached a sort of maximum now where like, okay, we can't be more than 400 people on working on something. But the salaries have really evolved. Like when I started, I earned, even if I had a university degree and everything, I earned less than I would at McDonald's. And I would be super happy with that. That's not the case anymore. Now it's like an industry and people pick game development as a profession rather than a passion. Everybody's paid much more accordingly to sort of more competitive salaries compared to other industries, right? So like the cost per employee as a double or triple compared to when I started, right? And then you have 400 people, 500 people. And like working at those big studios, you realize how much inefficiencies there are and how much work goes into the bin. Yep. And you kind of go like, that's not sustainable. I understand that's why they're increasing the prices now. So like, okay, you're buying a AAA for what? Like $80 to $100 or something like that?
Yeah, $80 like, US. Yeah. $90 US. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the deluxe edition is over 100. Yeah, so it's like they have to increase the price. Like they have no choice but to increase the price to kind of sustain what they are doing. And then probably hoping that they will sell the same amount of copies they used to. We'll see if that's true. I think some games will survive, but I think we're seeing a lot of studios going down, and I think we're going to see a lot more studios going down because the competition is fierce.
Yeah. And the other problem I think is in America specifically is American salaries are much higher than the rest of the world. So and a lot of the big AAA studios are there. So I remember speaking to one of the Nintendo producers. He worked for Nintendo, he worked for Activision, he worked for EA. And I think he said that for a $100 million budget game you have to sell about 6 million now to break even. Mm.
That sounds low. I think you need to sell more. Yeah, sure. I buy that.
But on average, still,
yeah, and that's going to be hard. Because the thing is, it's also like back like when I was 20, so like 15 years ago or whatever, like, you know, there's a reason. Like, okay, I don't know if this is true, but, you know, do you know what AAA comes from? Like, why is it called AAA game?
Well, no, I don't actually know, actually. So this is good education.
Yeah. It's a bit of a nugget. I don't know if it's true, but I think it's true. And that is because when you're looking at countries and companies, or like when you're, there are like companies who rate other companies. Like if you want to give a loan to someone, you have a rating of like, is this a safe investment? Like a bank would give me a loan for a house, let's say, they could rate me to be like, okay, is Philip a sort of a person who will pay his dues or no? And they have like a rating for that. So like America has a rating. So if you're borrowing money to America, for example, you can look up, everybody can look up the rating. And the rating is, you know, AAA, AAB, AABB or BBB. So it's like a rating of how safe investment it is.
Wow.
So like, so if you would borrow money to say India or China, that would be a lower rating than the US. But the US is not the highest rating anymore. And that was a bit of a drama, but that happened. Then you have other countries who are AAA, whatever. So I think it comes from that mindset that like in the, when that was coined, it was more like, this is a safe bet. You know, this studio is making game X and it's a safe bet. So this is a AAA investment. And now we make that equivalent to a big budget, which was kind of true for a while. But I think that's changing. People don't really care about, you know, the sculpted tear canals of characters anymore. They care about what you do in the game and sort of the dynamic interaction you have with the game. Or sort of, you know, this very complex set of parameters per person, right? What makes you, what makes that tick? And it's clear it's not necessarily big budgets. You have some games that probably will survive the test of time. You know, I truly believe Call of Duty, for example, is one of them. That like they can, they know what they're doing, and it's like going to McDonald's. You know, sometimes you just want a hamburger, and like it's not the best burger, but you know what you're gonna get. Same with Call of Duty. You like sometimes I just want to blow stuff up, and then I go to the Call of Duty, or maybe Diablo, maybe
World of Warcraft.
Battlefield. Yeah. World of Warcraft could be a good example. So like those will remain. But the rest I think is shifting a little bit and we don't really know where it's going to go. So that's kind of interesting. But yeah, 6 million copies for, you say $100 million? No?
Yeah, 100 million, 6 million units.
I think that's too low. It has to be more.
Well, what do you think it is? Well, are we talking like 8 million? Like, because obviously no, you have to take into
10
account.
10 million, maybe.
10 million? You think 10... So 100 million, you need to sell 10 million units.
I'm thinking, okay, if this is a AAA company with the waste they have in terms of manpower and the salaries that they have in the US, yeah, I think 6 million is probably like a barely break even, yeah.
That's crazy, man. Mm. It's probably a little bit easier for like, say, Sony and Nintendo because they don't have to pay like the 30%. Because you know how Steam takes a 30% cut.
Yeah.
So with their exclusives, obviously they get 100% of the profit if it's digital, right? If they're buying digitally, as opposed to retail, because retail take quite a bit as well. So
yeah.
Man, that's crazy if that's true though. 10 million units.
I mean, this is just top of my head. Yeah, we're theorizing. But yeah, like that's why I'm like, shit, 99.99% are failing. Like it's so fierce. So we'll see where, to me, I feel like the industry is really in sort of a shift right now. We don't really know where we're going to be in 5 years in terms of like how many AAAs are going to be there, how many AAs are going to be there, because they are shutting down left and right here in Stockholm as well. A lot of them are struggling finding finance. Yeah, a lot.
I thought Europe was doing a bit better than the US.
Or is it the same? I'm not so sure. I think it's because we don't get as much publication. But like we don't end up in the news as much as Americans do for some reason.
That's probably true. Most of the media, most of the news is all American-centric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like from my perspective, you know, like we have a bunch of younger colleagues in the studio and, you know, their friends lose their jobs. And they, you know, they get a bit worried. And it's interesting because like me and friends of my age kind of like, has a very different perspective because like we were about to join the industry in 2008, you know, with the financial crisis. And back then, at least in Sweden, we had like 4 or 5 big studios. It was like DICE. We had Grin was a big studio. We had Starbreeze, Massive Entertainment and Avalanche Studios. Those were the 5. And over the course of 1 week, one of them went bankrupt. The other one had to cut half the staff, meaning the entire country had now, like, the entire Swedish gaming industry had like 25-30% of the workforce out of a job. And that's where I'm coming in, like, hey, I'm from school, you know, like I'm good at making levels and shit. And they're like, yeah, you read the news? Literally, that's what I heard. Like, I was going for an interview and they're like, have you read the news? Yes. Okay, maybe we should reschedule or maybe never ever talk again. I'm like, okay, cool. So what happened then, because that was like, I mean, you can't even compare to today. Back then, like that amount of people, like you would have to go abroad. So I had buddies who just went to the UK or looked at the US. And, you know, if the 1 or 2 years, it all kind of settled and sort of adjusted and more money flew in or whatever. And then you could get a job again. But like that really sort of made a mark in sort of how I look at things. So I keep reminding everybody, like, this is nothing compared to how bad it could be. And sort of back in my day, I was hell bent. Like I have, it's like, I don't have a choice. In my head, I had to work in the gaming. I cannot work at anything but making games. If that makes me travel the world, then so be it. Like that was like, yep. Yeah. So I was getting a university degree for one reason, and that was to get in the US easier. Because you could get an e-visa easier if you had a university degree or something like that, I think. So I was just like, I remember calling my mom and like, yeah, there was a studio in Belarus who was looking for a level designer. And she's like, you don't go there, man. Like, you're not going to Belarus to work like that. You can work wherever you want, but not Russia and not Belarus. And this was, yeah, like back then, you know, it wasn't like Russia was not what it was to, you know, like obviously she had been living through a little bit more of the Cold War or the end of Cold War. And me growing up in the 90s, like Russia was not this sort of, yeah, it was more like a joke when they had the submarines coming into Swedish. Yeah.
She made the right call. Yeah.
Yeah, she made the right call. Like, what if I ended up there? It's like crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's where I come from, where like, yeah, like working abroad was probably the only option I had in my head, at least. So yeah, it can go that bad for sure. Yeah.
Well, I just hope that the game is a continued success. I don't want to end on a down note, but I will ask, are you planning to release, well, when it's actually released, are you going to release it on consoles as well? Like PlayStation and Switch? I mean, I don't know what the heck's happening with Xbox 100%. And Microsoft at the moment, but...
Yeah, so the game is out on Xbox right now. It's maybe not in the best shape, but we decided to go with one console, and so we're so small that we couldn't like do all the consoles at the same time. It turned out that we're a bit overstretched. The Xbox version is a bit undercooked at the moment, which is super embarrassing. But like, we're doing everything we can to fix that. But I think we will have it sorted out quite soon. And then, you know, once we've done one console, it's much easier to do two or three consoles. So absolutely. But which consoles, you know, you never know what's going to happen in a year or 2 years from now. Whether that's going to be maybe Nintendo, what is it, Switch 2 or whatever, like maybe that's the coolest thing on the market. Maybe there is a new Steam Deck handheld kind of ish thing that, you know, everybody's talking about. Maybe that's interesting. We'll have to be nimble and see where the industry is at that point. It seems like things are moving really quickly, but yeah, long answer, but short one would be yes.
Yeah. Well, the industry, as you said, is changing so fast, so quickly, and you have to try and be as agile as possible and pivot quickly if you need to. It's probably easier to do as an indie. It would be a lot harder to do if you're a AAA.
Yeah.
Because there'd be a lot more bureaucracy involved and a lot more risk and so forth.
But yeah. I mean, for us, it's like one conversation. Somebody says, you know what? Should we do Switch 2? And I'm like, yeah, it feels good. Okay. That's it. Versus that would be a massive endeavor just to come up to the decision in a big company. Absolutely.
Well, cool, Philip. Cool. I could talk to you for hours, man. This has been great. But I will let you get back to it. But all the best with Jump Space, and I'm speaking to you and the entire team. I hope it's a continued success, and you keep building and building on it. Yeah, it's cool that you've had this idea since 2012, and it's come to fruition. That must be very cathartic in a way.
Yeah. But it's a long process. Like, I don't think I've internalized the game is out. I feel like it's probably going to take a few years before, like, you feel like, okay, it's over now.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. Like, yeah, it's like how many people can live with that story and sort of feel like they've actually, it actually came to be. It happened, right? After all these years. I'm very fortunate.
Yep. So if anybody wants to check this out or stay up to date with what you and Keepsake Games are doing, where's the best place for them to do that?
So, I mean, we have our Discord channel, which is like, that's the center of where everything is happening. But like, you can buy the game on Steam. I think that's the preferable place, like Jump Space on Steam. And I think we have like a trillion links to the Discord channel. That's where all the devs are hanging out. I'm hanging out there every day. So like, we're having a dialogue with the Steam community constantly. So yeah, if you want to reach out to me, I think that's even the best, to just ping me on Discord and maybe I'll answer.
If you're not busy, yeah.
If I'm not busy, I'll try to, like, sometimes I'm busy, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.